This episode of Vintage Stormfront Freaks has been previously recorded.
So everybody knows him as Dr. Greg Forbes, and it's really... I don't know. We don't even have to do a real intro for Dr. Forbes, but some people may not know, you know, beyond the Weather Channel, what Dr. Forbes did before the Weather Channel. But we like to call Dr. Forbes Storm Master G. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but Storm Master G received his master's and doctorate degrees at the University of Chicago, where he studied tornadoes and severe thunderstorms under Ted Fujita, who was famous for his invention of the F-scale used to rate tornadoes. He joined the faculty in the Department of Meteorology at Penn State in 1978. And there were actually a lot of people that worked at the Weather Channel who had Dr. Forbes as their teacher, by the way. He taught courses in weather analysis and forecasting until joining the Weather Channel in June of 1999. Dr. Forbes developed the Weather Channel Torcon forecast and retired from there in 2018. And Dr. Forbes, such an honor. We've been wanting to get you on this show for so long. And I remember meeting you in 99, and to me, you were a hero because, as you know, I was so fascinated by the 74 outbreak, and I knew you were instrumental in that outbreak and with, you know, developing the F scale. So that was such a huge honor for me, and you were so kind and took time to look at some of my old magazines and even some pictures I had. So I appreciate that. But I think a lot of us are, we never thought you'd retire. We know you kept coming back to the Weather Channel, and then, you know, you'd leave for a little while and come back again. But before we get into the really, really, you know, good questions, not that my questions can be bad, but you're retired. So what does a Storm Master G do when they're retired?
Well, for one thing, I take a hike pretty much every day. I hike the various trails of the Chattahoochee around here. It sort of takes me back to my boyhood days. I grew up out in the country of Western Pennsylvania, and we had a wooded area. So I would be out playing in the woods all the time. So I like hiking those nature trails. I try to take the trails that have uphill parts to them, so I get some cardio workout in the process. So that's the main thing. Up until the COVID lockdown here, or at least the trying to be safe, I was going out and picking, going out to estate sales and thrift stores and so on to pick up various miscellaneous things. You see some of them behind me, but mostly I was looking for signed books and sell some of those on the web, the ones that I don't want to keep. So that was kind of my hobby. I'm still selling some, but I haven't been going out buying anymore. I watch sports also.
Of course.
You got to get the sports in. But do you miss it? Like, do you miss the craziness, or do you like kicking back?
I like kicking back. I haven't been watching the weather all that much. Lately, though, I sort of always wind up going back to my damage surveying roots. The remnants of Hurricane Zeta came up here through the north suburbs, at least of the Atlanta metro area, and were hit pretty hard. There was a home damaged in my subdivision, and there were trees down. So in my nature hikes, I've been counting how many trees that I see in each one of the various parks that have been knocked down by the ex-hurricane winds. I'm looking to see if I can find any pattern to it. There might have been a little bit of a meso-low that was in there. I could see a little bit of a counterclockwise swirl, but not concentrated enough that I could find any mini tornadoes or anything like that.
That's so cool. I want to go hiking with you next time, Greg. I swear.
Yeah, seriously. Like,
that is so neat. And I have to ask you this because I actually... So I was so lucky to be your weather producer on the weekend on Saturdays. It was just you and I, and Kim sometimes too. That's it was right. The three of us. Oh, yeah. And it was so much fun. But from your estate sales, like, what is the biggest and most amazing prize possession you've ever gotten, like signed book?
Well, probably my biggest prize possession. I have a book that was written by Secretary of State, what's her name? Female Secretary of State.
Rice? Condoleezza Rice?
Condoleezza Rice.
Prior to that, it was, she was.
Albright?
Albright. Madeleine Albright.
Oh, right.
And she was in the Carter administration, but then when she wrote a book, there's a book that's signed, Dear President Carter, with my, I enjoyed being in your administrations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that one is certainly prized. There's another Georgia political official that signed and endorsed the book to President Carter, and one that he and Mrs. Carter signed and gave to someone else. So wow. So those are prized possessions, but kind of quite a few, amazingly, at these for pick up for a couple bucks, amazing number of signed autographs that I was able to come up with over the past few years.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so awesome. So what was it like to be a student under Ted Fujita? Like, just what was it like?
Well, it was really exciting because you were working with somebody that was famous. I went to the University of Chicago specifically because I knew he was there. He was why I applied there. Otherwise, I would have probably gone to some other school. But I was very lucky that he was able at the last minute to get some financial, get a grant to come in that I was able to then go to graduate school there. Each day, almost every morning, he would come clip-clopping. You'd hear his footsteps coming down the hall from the back elevator down toward his office. And he would set down his books and briefcase and so on. And before long, he'd be calling out for me to come down and wanted to show me or discuss with me what he had done the night before. He would take material home. Usually he would do a lot of those fancy drafting, those drawings that he's so famous for. He would take those home at night, draw them up, and then bring them in to show. And so that was always exciting. A lot of times he and I would go out on ground damage surveys and sometimes aerial damage surveys and those together. So those were interesting. Sometimes he would send me out as the advance party. And if there wasn't anything too spectacular, I would just do it. But if I found something new that I thought he maybe hadn't seen before, some kind of phenomenon, I'd call him and he'd come out and look at it himself as well.
That is so cool.
That's got to be cool. It would be nice having you as a neighbor, because if there's storm damage, I could just have you come over, rate it for me, and then I could call the insurance company.
Yeah, that's true. The before the Remnants of Zeta came, there's a neighborhood Facebook page, the private Facebook page, that I had told people that they better have their flashlights handy before they went to bed that night. But the damage was worse than I expected it to be. I didn't expect people to, well, we were without power for pretty close to 24 hours in the neighborhood.
Wow.
And without cable and internet for pretty much 3 days. So it was a real mess up in that area with, so many, part of the main road going one way out of my subdivision was blocked for a couple of days also, but there were other ways to go.
Now, Dr. do you have Ford, a generator?
Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, do you have a generator then when the power goes out?
I do not have a generator. The one night when it was pretty obvious, I went to a hotel so I could watch a football game.
What game?
I think it was probably the Thursday night football game, I guess.
Yeah,
Zeta hit Thursday morning, 4:30 Thursday morning or whatever. So I went to watch some Thursday night football game rather than just sit in the dark and do nothing.
Hey, that was Carolina, because didn't we have Brad Panovich on two weeks ago when that was going through?
That's right. It was Carolina, now that you mention it.
Isn't it crazy how we are now without power and without power, without internet? It's like I'm going to see zombies outside, like it's The Walking Dead. The kids don't know what to do with themselves.
Yeah, I know. With that television, without being able to mess around on the computer, the cell phone and the iPad, I have various wireless subscriptions that are not part of the cable system for those, fortunately. So I did have some way of being connected, but it was where I live is not in a very good cell phone reception. It's kind of in a low spot right down along Soap Creek, and so I don't get very good cell phone reception. So to to be able to really do much communicating, I had to drive away out to some place near a cell phone tower to get a little quicker response.
It's so crazy. Jen, I just wanted to ask Dr. Forbes, have you ever done any actual storm chasing? So not the aftermath, but the actual, you know, there was a movie Twister, and I don't know if you've heard of it. I'm just wondering, you know, how, like, was that part of your research? Was that part of the work that you did at the time?
That was not part of what I did or what Dr. Fujita did at the University of Chicago. We would be going out and looking at the damage after the fact, or what we did in real time was we would sometimes charter a Learjet to be flying up at cloud top, going back and forth to monitor if there was up or down motion in the clouds. That was the early stages of development of geostationary satellite. And the question was, could you learn anything about collapsing or quickly rising cloud tops that related to tornado formation at the ground? And Dr. Fujita had grants with NESSS, the satellite folks, to look into that. So I'd be flying around in Learjet instead of chasing them on the ground.
Best once I went to ever.
That was pretty exciting. Although it was so cold there that the windows would fog over, so they had to blow hot air off the tubes off the manifold against the window. And if the at those altitudes, if the window would happen to crack, we'd have been dead in like 3 seconds from the decompression. Oh, so it was a little bit of nervous. And some of the landings behind the dry line in those real strong crosswinds, we'd come in at like crabbing, as we'd call it, like a 45 degree angle. In the very last second, the pilot would tip his wing down, and we'd be pointing the plane that way and flying that way. And we'd always wish ourselves, well, it's been good knowing you, just before we make the landing.
Did you fly above the thunderstorms, or did you fly? I mean, you didn't fly through them, right? Because that.
No, we didn't try flying through them. At the very end, they raised the ceiling where how high the Learjet was allowed to fly. So in the, I think it was 77, we actually were able to fly over some thunderstorm tops that weren't that high, and we found a little dimple that had gone down, a little trench, and that collapsed part seemed to be the one that related that we did find in those cases that there were tornadoes with those. The big overshooting tops did not. Remind me, I'll come back and answer your original storm chasing question, but probably the worst day of studying with Dr. Fujita was back. Omaha, Nebraska got hit May 6, 1975, got hit by a tornado, went right through part of the western part of the urbanized area. And we were at in a Learjet that day. I was in charge. We were looking for overshooting tops. And so we were looking around. We looked up in that area. The tops were just flat as pancakes. And there was nothing to see going up or down. And so we flew down to Oklahoma, where we could see some of the storms going up and down. So we thought we had a pretty good mission. We landed, we're, I think, either refueling or going to dinner, and saw on the television it was all just covered by the Omaha had gotten hit by a tornado. And so we drew straws to see, and of course it was always me that had to sort of be the person to sort of smooth out the rough parts there. So I had to tell Dr. Fujita that we weren't flying that storm. So he said, well, get out there tomorrow and do a damage survey. So the plan changed.
I was in Omaha. I was actually there during that tornado as young child.
Know that.
Yeah.
A youngin.
That was the storm that got me interested in becoming a meteorologist, believe it or not. But listen, Dr. Forbes, did you ever accidentally miss storms and like end up in like Bermuda, Jamaica, Bahamas, in your Learjet?
Sorry, Dr. Fujita, I don't know what happened.
Didn't do that. Never did that. Sometimes the crew would, after we were done flying for the day, you know, things would get a little crazy. The one time we wound up at the big Texan steak ranch in Amarillo, where some of you have been there, I guess, where the their claim to fame or whatever was a 72-ounce strip steak or something like that. If you could eat it and all the baked potato and salad and so on, if you could eat it, I think it was like an hour time limit or whatever, you got it free. So we egged on the co-pilot, who was sort of a big burly guy, like a football player looking guy. We egged him on and he did it, but he was washing down the last few bites with iced tea or whatever, just drinking it down whole. He was he was sick the next day. I'm glad we didn't need a co-pilot because he was he was just slumped over the
good thing you weren't stuck in a plane with him while he was in the lavatory.
Pilot has the meat sweats.
So going back to your original question about the did I ever do some storm chasing? So the primary amount of storm chasing I did was with the Weather Channel team, Mike Bettis and his storm chasing, the storm tracking team. And also with the storm riders. I was with the storm riders that making specials for the Weather Channel for two summers.
Dustin for like and Simon, a week. Right?
Yeah, Simon and Justin.
Yeah.
And then with Bettis and his team, I'd go out for about 5 days. I think 2010, 11, 12, 13, I think, with Mike and the storm track team at the Weather Channel. So I saw some tornadoes in that, had some great experiences. But other than that, I was most of the time in places that Chicago or Pennsylvania that were not storm chasing territory.
Right on.
So Dr. Forbes, in your career, what do you think was the greatest discovery or greatest achievement for forecasting tornadoes?
That's a great question.
That is a great question. And I think the answer would have to be twofold. If you made it warning and forecasting, I'd have separate answers for each of those. For warning, it's definitely Doppler radar. That has taken us from just very crude ability to detect the precipitation part. And some of my PhD thesis was looking at the super outbreak, what the radar looked like of the tornadic storms in the super outbreak. But your detection rate and your false alarm rate were not very good from non-Doppler radar. It has gone up, way up since Doppler, and now with dual pole and your ability to see the debris signatures, it's gone up even higher. And of course, the resolution is so much better, the computerization, so you can track things and see animations and put it into computer programs that project where the communities downstream are going to be that get hit and when. All of that is just tremendous advancements in the warning phase of things. In the prediction phase of things, it's certainly the continued advancement of computers that allowed for the continued advancement of the sophistication of computer forecasts. That, man, compared to when I was a student to now, when I was a student, the resolution was grid points were 250 miles apart. You didn't even hope to be able to see a thunderstorm, let alone and now the resolution is so much that you can actually predict and pretty realistic looking thunderstorm shapes. They track updraft, helicity, the rotation, the maximum rotation that's developing in those computer predicted storms that relates pretty well to whether there's going to be supercells. So you can use the computer to predict all of these parameters that relate directly, the instability parameters, the rotation parameters, the wind shear and the vertical. All of those are done pretty well as just the type of precipitation patterns. It's amazing. They don't always exactly get it to the hour or to the county, but they get pretty close in terms of telling you that somewhere in the pretty close vicinity of a community these days might have a supercell go right through in the next afternoon.
So back in the day, they didn't have a class where you picked up dirt and dropped it to see where everything was going to go.
No, we had classes when I was an undergrad, I mentioned Dr. Fujita had a research grant from NESDS, the satellite folks. Well, Penn State had one of those Nezis guys. In fact, the guy that was the grant monitor for Dr. Fujita, his name was Vince Oliver. He would come in and teach for a week or two at Penn State, and he would bring along all that fancy material that Dr. Fujita was drawing up, and he would show us all those satellite results and all those surface analyses and the F-scale and the damage surveys and so on that Dr. Fujita had done. So we weren't dropping dust or whatever, but I was seeing, you know, the future there of what could be done in terms of tornadoes research. And so that's how and why I wound up making such a concerted effort to go to the University of Chicago and study with Fujita.
So Dr. Forbes, what's the end game then when it comes to forecasting? Like if you had a crystal ball to look, you know, another 50 years out from now, how good can the forecasting get? I mean, there's still all these, you know, it's weather, it's the atmosphere, you can't control it. But what's the possibility, and what would be the golden egg for you that's like, man, we'll be able to do this at some point?
Again, I think it's probably kind of like two scales in terms of longer term forecasting of sort of saying which days might have tornado outbreaks. I think we're headed toward a limit there of probably about 10 days from what some of the researchers indicate is the limit of predictability in terms of predicting those. When I was in graduate school in the 70s, about 3 days, I think, were the limit. And the Storm Prediction Center, at least by its different name at the time, it didn't try to make any forecasts more than a day in advance. But now they're making forecasts for up to 5 days or so, specific ones out to 3 days or so. And so I think there, ultimately, the limit is going to be there's still the input data. There's gaps in that input data that over time, those become bigger errors in the forecast that will ultimately limit our probably ability to make specific daily forecasts out to about 10 days in advance. Then you get down on the small scale, and they're beginning to use over the United States, for example, where we have Doppler radars covering the whole country, put that data from the Doppler radars in to fill in some of those gaps so that out to 24 hours for sure, maybe out to 48 hours or a little bit beyond, you can get these cloud resolving models that are producing more and more accurate forecasts of the tracks of individual supercell thunderstorms that the models predict. And the future is the National Weather Service is planning to transfer from warning on detection, instead of issuing warnings for tornadoes based upon where they see the hook echoes or see the tornadoes on radar now, and then just projecting based upon its previous movement where it will go in the next half hour to an hour. They're planning to go to warning on forecast, that it'll be some blend of where the storms are detected, plus where these computer models are predicting there's going to be sometimes dissipating existing storms, formation of new storms, and then timelining out ahead where those threats are going to be. So it's challenging, but exciting times ahead. That's probably not more than 10 years down the line.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's great.
Welcome to Outbreak, a new live stream format brought to you by the Stormfront Freaks podcast, hosted by me, meteorologist Brady Harris, also known as Stormcat 5. We'll go live on days of extreme weather with the goal of keeping you safe, informed, and entertained. The only question that remains is, are you ready for the outbreak?
All right. Hey, we're excited to have Rob Marciano, another paisan, on the show tonight, senior meteorologist of ABC's World News Tonight and the weekend edition of GMA Good Morning America. Now, since joining the network, he has reported on nearly every natural disaster to hit the United States. Marciano has covered tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, and blizzards, even erupting volcanoes surrounding towns in Hawaii. Now, before joining ABC News, Marciano was the co-host of Da na 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 na. What's that?
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, what is that, guys? It's Entertainment Tonight.
Which makes perfect sense.
Yes, and CNN. So, Rob, welcome. And okay, so yeah, how long were you on ET?
I didn't even make it 2 years before the weather bug snipped me back. It was a job I couldn't say no to. I was at CNN for 10 years, and they were starting to go heavy into the politics and the talking heads and less into the weather, and it fell on my lap. So I said, what the heck? It was a wild ride. And then before my deal wasn't even up there, ABC came calling, and I've always wanted to work at ABC. So I begged out and dragged my family across the country again. to New York. So that's where that came from. I'm happy to answer any of your celebrity questions.
So every single natural disaster, just about, what's the most memorable out of all of that list?
You know, it's funny. I guess it's the two most memorable are not even weather related. The BP oil spill, because that was so monumental, you know, as a country and a coastline, and it was so drawn out, and it's still, you know, affecting our ocean or a gulf down there. And then covering volcanoes in Hawaii, which is, you know, something I've only seen from afar, and then, you know, basically chasing lava, and then learning about all the different cultures involved with lava, and those are the two most memorable. But obviously the big hurricanes and some of the bigger tornadoes and smaller tornado chases are all very, very dear to my heart. It's been, you guys are all weather geeks, you know the drill. I mean, it's, I don't want to say they all blend together, but after the top three or four, they do start to blend together a little bit.
Now, do you go out?
I'm gonna ask this quick, because you mentioned it. You said weather geeks, but you talked about the volcano. I'm really curious, because of all the meteorologists we have in the group, there probably hasn't been a lot of volcano coverage amongst you. So I'm curious, what are the safety protocols when you go to do a live hit from a volcano eruption?
Well, you get the obligatory email from the bosses to be safe and don't do anything.
But get right up to it.
But get real close.
Yeah, get as close as possible.
Then they're in the control room, and you know, no, it's honestly, it's a, we hired a fixer out of a Walgreens parking lot, as a matter of fact, a local guy that said, I can get you to the lava. And Travis, we'll just say his name is Travis. He basically, you know, knew everybody and, you know, would ask, get us past people's yards by knocking on the door and say, hey, can these guys walk through? And then taking us through the jungle to get to basically the little lava front. And then, I mean, honestly, protocols, I mean, just, you know, when your feet start to get hot, go the other way.
When things start lighting on fire.
Yeah.
Start smoking
over my shoes. And then when that lava gets close, and it doesn't even have to be that, the thing I take away from the lava deal is that your hair on your arms and the back of your neck starts to singe way faster than you think. You know,
wow.
It's only, you know, it's 20 feet away, 30 feet away, and you're feeling that intense 2000 degree heat. It's pretty amazing. Some flow faster than others, and you just got to be quick on your feet.
So you
said, they flow down, you know, they follow gravity. So, you know, as long as you're kind of uphill from the flow, basically it's, you know, like a river. So that's the number one school of thought.
That's the hope.
Yeah, right? I'm worried that it's going to like explode and like rain lava. And like, what do you do?
Well, if you're up near the crater rim, then that's the thing. We were more chasing the flow as it got towards towns. So you're on the front, and there are fissures along that front. But generally speaking, there's not going to be any explosions other than the lava hitting a batch of trees or a bush or some gas and then popping in front of you there. But I wasn't, it wasn't that scary. It was amazingly intense, but, I never felt like, you know, like as scared as I felt in storms.
Do you wear really? Something special wow. or just like add hair gel or like, what do you do?
Yeah, hair gel, gel in the hair, and then, you know, protective layer of Vaseline everywhere. No,
that's a big job.
Kind of like wildfires.
Careful.
You guys didn't even ask me what I was drinking. So,
what are you drinking?
Oh my gosh!
I mentioned it before we got started that I had some Indian food that I'm not quite done with. So I was drinking an IPA.
Awesome.
The Rebel IPA, but I felt obligated to pour a 14-year Balvenie Caribbean cask.
Nice.
In honor of, I'm sure, the hurricanes we'll talk about. So
beer before whiskey, just saying.
So Rob, I think I'm curious, and this is kind of a broader question. I know probably a lot of our viewers have this question too. So when there is something like a volcano or a hurricane about to happen, is it ABC that comes to you and says, hey, we want you to go to the front lines? Or do you kind of, because I'm sure with your love of weather, you probably want to be there too. Is it a little bit of both, or how does that process work?
Well, in the very beginning, it was, I didn't have to raise my hand. When you're the shiny new toy, and this happens to everybody who comes on board at ABC, you get abused and they want to play with a shiny new toy for, you know, 6 months to a year or so. And no one wants to say no. Because you're the new guy. So in the beginning, it's they're always calling you, and then after they're done abusing you, they give you a break, and then you can kind of get thrown into the when it's weather related, I get first right of refusal. So if it's a storm that's not that, you know, doesn't seem that to be that big, they'll call me and say, hey, is this bad enough for you to go? You think it's worth it? And then there'll be times where, you know, it's maybe not going to be that big of a storm, but I just want to get into it. And it's like my schedule works out to where I want to get into it, and then I'll push for it. But ABC is very big into weather. They're not shy about going to the front. They're not shy about pre-positioning, be it any storm, including tornadoes. We'll pre-position 3 or 4 teams on a moderate to high risk day just to catch damage. And then, you know, as far as chasing goes, Ginger and I are really the only ones who will actually go chase. Everyone else just kind of holds up until something happens. So God bless ABC. I mean, it's so much fun to work for them. I didn't think growing up, you know, watching Peter Jennings, that there'd be a need for a meteorologist at the network level. I never thought as a meteorologist that would be on network television, but here we are. And I'm grateful for it. It's been awesome. We're just kind of riding the wave.
So, if for something like Laura, how early do you go out and get ready?
So, Laura, you know, kind of got itself together relatively quickly. You know, the Laura thing was interesting in that we had Marco to deal with too.
Mm-hmm.
So, this was a rare occasion where I really pushed back on them sending me down to go pre-position for Marco and then move to wherever Laura was. And for slightly selfish reasons, I said, you know what, let's just wait a day. We're not quite sure where this is going. And basically I haven't seen my kids in 2 weeks. So, and then sure enough, later that day, like Marco goes from kind of slowly drifting its way into Corpus Christi to beelining it to New Orleans a day early. And so I had to scramble, call my boss, plead, you know, apologize and like get on a plane and get there. So to answer your question, if it's a Cape Verde storm like Florence was, we were there for 6 days before it made land.
6 days. Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of pregame. It's a lot of hey, the water's gonna be over my head. It's a lot of a lot of drone shots and a lot of making of television. And you try to do it as informative and then visually captivating as possible, which can be a challenge sometimes.
So what's your downtime like then? If you've got 6 days out there, you're like, yeah, everything. And then you're like, we're going to the bars over here.
Well, yeah. I wish that way. Unfortunately, when it's like that, that's what takes the most amount of work to make television. So, yeah. It's like these guys at ESPN the past 6 months. I feel so bad for them. They've had to work 10 times harder than they've ever had to make some television out of nothing. And similarly, you know, especially if it's way out there, way, way, way out there, and there's not even preps going on. I mean, you got to get really creative as far as how you do a prep piece. So basically, Good Morning America airs at 7 a.m. And then, so you're on there from 7 to 9. You might have some digital obligations. So you're not cleared until 9:30 or 10. And then you have to file for World News Tonight, which is, you know, at 6:30. So however you want to manage your day to get another piece done for World News, and in my case, and or a forecast, you go about that. So if you have to run around and shoot a piece, you may have to, you know, drive somewhere. You may have to go drive 3 hours to get on a helicopter to fly 20 minutes back to where you were, you know, just to get a chopper live shot in. It really depends. But in an ideal world, you get a couple of hours downtime just to recharge. Hopefully if your hotel is anywhere close before you start up for, so it's a bit of a hamster wheel, morning news, evening news. When I worked at CNN, it was more of a larger chunk, you know, 10 hours, and then you're sort of done. Whereas this is kind of a double shift kind of deal. Mm-hmm. And that's the way all most network correspondents work.
So Rob, I have to ask you, have you ever been on a Hurricane Hunter mission? Have you ever been given that opportunity to do that? And I know you've covered just every type of weather and then some. What is the most memorable hurricane that you've covered that was just like, wow, like the devastation, I just can't believe that.
Okay. Well, to answer the first question of being on a Hurricane Hunter mission, I have been on training missions. I've been on one P3 mission into a Pacific storm, but I've never been on a Hurricane Hunter mission into the eye of a hurricane. And that's because by the time it's either way out there, you know, in the Lesser Antilles somewhere where it takes 2 days just to get to it, or it's getting closer and they don't want you wasting 12 hours to come back with the same picture that people always get of you know, the Met officer dropping the drop zone and, you know, some shaky things out the window. It's that's hard to make television out of. As important as that mission is to all that we do and all that we prepare for and all the decisions that governments have to make, as important as that is, it's difficult to make television out of it, and it takes so much time to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's the time constraints that have limited most of us from going onto those missions. As far as the most memorable hurricanes, I mean, they're like my children. You know, I don't have they all have their different personalities. Katrina is Katrina, obviously. I think that Rita was probably the most memorable as far as an experience and something that I was like, we were in a dicey spot. And so I always like to have a backup position. Obviously I always like to have a fallback position. I wasn't comfortable. I was sharing a truck with another CNN anchor who had a little more power than me. So that person didn't want to move. And so we were a little exposed, and when it started getting dicey, I called it and my team, we had a scramble to a utility company building. It was a brick building where they were opening the doors for basically anybody who needed last minute shelter. And just getting to that part, getting out of the car and trying to get to the door, the wind, I'm pretty sure there was a tornado embedded because we were in the eye wall at that point. Just trying to get to the door, we're being blown across the parking lot. My producer was a fantastic, but small, you know, all of 120, 30 pounds, maybe, female producer that literally got blown across the parking lot.
Wow.
And so I had to go struggle to get her, grab her by the scruff of the neck or the back of her hood of her jacket, and drag her across the parking lot and into this building. Wow. So that was a scary experience, and it was something I feared was going to happen, and it did. And I try not to put I'm much more forceful now as far as not backing down when I know where I need to be to keep my team safe, because I don't want, you know, if a regular reporter gets hurt or an anchor's with a crew and someone in the crew gets hurt,
no big deal.
Well, it's honestly not a big deal, but if I get hurt or someone on my team gets hurt as a meteorologist,
yeah,
that's some serious egg in your face.
You're never going to hear the end of that.
No, you won't.
Yeah, so
it'll go viral.
I don't want my epitaph to read that, you know, weatherman dies of stupidity in a storm. Mm-hmm. So I think about that all the time, and it's an anxious thing that I'm concerned about the team's well-being. So I'm a little bit more chicken in that regard, but safety first, right? As far as the most intense damage I've ever seen, as far as tree damage, Maria in Puerto Rico, it looked like an atom bomb went off. Thousands, if not millions of trees completely blown away. And then honestly, I've never seen wind damage through a city like I saw in Lake Charles
And Rob, that leads me to this question about Lake Charles, because I was looking at your Twitter, and was that your first place you were on air, was Lake Charles?
Yeah, more or less. My first
full-time
job. Yeah, so it's a special place to me. If you guys who have worked in television, you go to the starter market, at least you used to before YouTube. It's like going to college again. You know, you're thrown into a station with a bunch of other young kids, mostly, and a couple of other locals that guide you and teach you, and you don't make any money, and you work your tail off and you learn the business. A lot of people have horror stories about their first markets. And even though I was nervous about going into the South as a Yankee, South Louisiana is not the South. It's so special. The people are so amazing. The Cajun and Creole cultures are so welcoming. So I made lifelong friends there. I waited. I spent 3 years there, which is longer than most people spend in their starter markets, and had a great time. So it really was tough to go down there and see the place get torn up like it did. And there's still, I'm talking to people nearly every day since.
And the station you worked at was.
Yeah, I was going to say, was that WAFB?
I would be KPLC.
Okay.
Channel 7. 7 at your service.
It was the transmission tower of KPLC, right?
The transmission tower, which is right over top of the station, which is something you don't really see very often, was cut in half, and the top of the tower came right down into the studio.
Oh, wow. Oh man.
So that was surreal to go back there and walk back there and see that. They had evacuated.
Oh, thank good.
So nobody was there, but they don't have a tower. I don't know how I got to call them tomorrow and see how they're broadcasting and where they're broadcasting from. National Weather Service, we went up there the day it was coming in. And the office that I'd called the National Weather Service office, and then some guy in Brownsville picks up. I'm asking questions about surge and trying to tell him who I am, like trying to get some inside track on what's going on with the storm, where I should be. He said, honestly, I'm in Brownsville. Lake Charles.
Oh, geez.
Lake Charles just passed everything off to us. I'm like, oh, really?
Oh my God. That's scary when you hear that.
Yeah, that is. When they leave.
Yeah, he's like, what are they doing? And he was a young guy. He's like, didn't want to say the right wrong thing. So he puts me on hold. And he comes back and he says, they are preparing for the possibility to evacuate. Okay. So they passed all off operations. I'm like, okay. So we're driving south of town to go see, catch somebody down south of the airport. So we're kind of driving past the airport. I say, let's turn in there and see what's up. And they're all poured it up. I'm knocking on the door. Ain't nobody there. They weren't preparing for the possibility. They were gone.
They were gone.
And that tells you something. And then the next day, the Doppler radar's right over top of their building. That dome was completely ripped apart.
Wow.
And that's not from debris, probably. You know, that's from 130 and 150 mile an hour winds.
Yeah.
Which is pretty
amazing. I think those are rated usually to 115 or 120 miles an hour. So that's pretty insane. They got ripped.
Yeah, I mean, I made the bold prediction. One of my guys, my crew, said, "Hey, what's going to happen to that?" I'm like, "It'll be fine. It's round, and you know, it's you know."
Wrong again. I don't think anybody thought that.
Thank you for tuning in to the Stormfront Freaks podcast. You can watch our bi-weekly show live on youtube.com/stormfrontfreaks and download the audio version on your favorite podcast player. For links to our Patreon team of exclusive benefits, show notes, past shows, new videos, merchandise, and more, visit our website at stormfrontfreaks.com. While you're there, check out our interactive chaser radar from our friends at zoomradar.com. If you'd like to contact us with questions or make comments about the show, shoot us an email to questions@stormfrontfreaks.com or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok. Search for Stormfront Freaks. We'd love to hear from you. Join us next time and tell a friend about the Stormfront Freaks podcast.